This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'm so excited for this opportunity to sit down with Thurston today to talk about art, music, film, poetry, and whatever else comes up. His breakfast stories are fascinating. It was a sound check. I'm also really excited to, I guess, have a conversation, as we will, about Maya Deren, who is a filmmaker who roamed New York in the 40s, 50s, and 60s and promoted film as art around the country. She's also been described as the godmother of the avant-garde film in America. Her life was art, her art was her life. Thurston Moore, who you'll meet very soon, has also lived a life in service to art. As a founding member of Sonic Youth, his guitar, I guess, became the frame which we have heard his voice. But Thurston has crossed many terrains, from improvisation to acoustic to noise disruption. And alongside his various activities in the musical world, he's also been involved with publishing and poetry and teaches writing annually at Naropa University. Yes. You're not here, but I'm just getting confirmation that that's true. He's the founder and senior editor of Ecstatic Peace Library, who publish art books and records, as well as the poetry imprint Flowers and Cream Press. He's on the faculty of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University. Please give him a Melbourne welcome, Thurston Moore. It's so wonderful to have you here today. We're going to go through, a lot of terrain. We're going to cover it. And initially, I think what I found really interesting when looking at Maya Deren, for example, is the incredible kind of intersections that you both have. You both shared New York as the city that birthed your art. You both are poets. And I think it would be fair to say, and definitely of Maya, but also of you, that there's been kind of a spiritual questioning that's been the basis of some of your art, which we'll get into soon. When did you first discover Maya Deren?
Maya Deren sort of came into my view as being part of this pantheon of New York avant-garde filmmakers, living in New York City. I lived in New York City since I was 19 years old. I moved there in around 1976. I was 18 at that time. I'm 61 now, so I've lived there for quite some time. And I was aware of her through her work as being part of the Anthology Film Archives, which was directed by Jonas Mekas, who was a champion of avant-garde film. He was a Lithuanian refugee from World War II who came to America when America was actually opening its arms to refugees from war-torn countries. And so he got involved, him and his brother moved to New York, and he got involved with the milieu of the art scene in New York City at that time, and particularly the more sort of marginalized avant-garde disciplines that were happening at the time in the 50s. And particularly filmmaking, and he had a column in the Village Voice where he would talk about experimental filmmaking and encouraging filmmakers who were working as outliers in cinema. And she was certainly part of that scene, and he recognized her work immediately as this work that was just primarily, in essence, like just this living poetry. And her, I don't really, I'm not like a great student of Maya Deren, but I became very sort of, I found her, the stills that I would see in film literature, which is all I could see, were stills. Jonas Mekas had a magazine called Film Journal. Right? I believe that's what it was called. Am I right about that?
Correction over there, Film Culture.
Film Culture, I'm sorry, yes. Andrew Saras had something on Film. Yes, Film Culture. And it was that was a fantastic magazine that sort of had lots of dialogue with different artists from different disciplines, but focusing on cinema. And so you would see stills from films that you could never see. So it was all sort of this thing of just this kind of stationary photographs. And so I would always see, you would always see this this still from Meshes of the Afternoon, which is sort of her centerpiece film in her life, that just looked really interesting because it was her, and she had the camera on herself in this this image of a woman sort of semi-concealed through gauze, like a curtain. And it was always very curious what was going on there. Never saw the film for many, many years later until it, you know, we had access to films as such. And I just thought it was one of the most, it was just one of the most alluring, beautiful, evocative films I had ever seen at that time.
When you're writing music for the four films that we saw last night, how do you go about it when your collaborator is no longer here and the films are there? I mean, do you take some inspiration from Teiji Ito, who originally wrote some music for some of that stuff, or what's your approach to the work with it?
Yeah, I didn't, you know, it's a little bit of a conflict because I'm not, you know, I think there's a lot of people who might have a very sort of purist take on like what a filmmaker's intention is with their work. And after the filmmaker is no longer with us, my Darren's sort of passed away at a too young of an age, especially as an artist, for what she was doing, and especially as a woman in the milieu that was so just like male-centric, which is very typical of all industries in the arts at that time. So she, you know, I try not to have any anxiety about, you know, what that regard would be. I just wanted to respond to the collaboration of working with just the piece itself and not personalize it so much. And it was all sort of instigated by a residency I had where in Paris a couple of years ago, where I was asked to do music in collaboration with film and an establishment in Paris. And so I had to sort of choose a selection of films and then choose other musical collaborators to work with me. And so I did something with the James Neres film where I played music with Erman Schmidt, the founder of Can, the German band. And I wanted to do something with Stephen O'Malley, the musician from Sun O. And so I chose these Maya Deren films because I thought they had this sort of this really sort of ethereal black and white kind of mystical vibe, and I thought that would be really suitable for Stephen O'Malley's interests as a musician, and so that was the first foray into that, and I thought it really worked nicely, and it was basically just improvised extreme noise drone music, you know, and so it was interesting because I didn't think like, well, what would Maya Deren or her estate think if they had heard, you know, these two gentlemen just sort of, you know, blowing the roof off this place while these films were being shown. So it was a bit of, but I just sort of saw it as juxtaposition, you know, for the most part.
It's fascinating because it is an improvisation, and for most of the improvised pieces that you're doing, you're not actually responding directly to the film. But what's interesting is this collision that happens organically where, and we saw it last night, beautiful moments where the music and the film are articulated perfectly. Is that kind of risk or that opportunity what you were looking to?
I was kind of inspired by the sort of this idea of sort of kind of magic counterpart, like with like of working in random and in tandem with two different disciplines. And years ago, I had the honor of and privilege of doing music for Merce Cunningham. I sort of did it with some other musicians, such as his director at the time, Takahisa Kasugi, who came after John Cage. After John Cage passed away, Takahisa Kasugi took over as the musical director of Merce Cunningham. But a lot of the pieces were based on Cage's idea with Merce, where he would construct music that did not, it wasn't informed by the dance. It was informed by this idea where Cage had score concepts that were based on time, and the only thing that was conducive to the dance was that amount of time. So if the dance was 60 minutes, he did a score for 60 minutes, and he had these score concepts where the musician could choose whatever they play, but as long as it sort of fit into the parameters of the score, and he would throw the I Ching. And the I Ching would sort of determine like how that score would be patterned. And so you would follow the score, and you would follow a clock, and on the score you would employ whatever you did as a musician to that signature of time. So you could be playing the spoons, or you could be playing like a violin, you could be playing anything. It was very liberating for the musician. It was very freeing. It was very just non-hierarchical, you know, like anybody could sort of be involved with it as long as you sort of understood when to come in and come out. And, you know, and so, but so when you would play this music, the dance was just sort of happening concurrently. And every time it was performed, it was completely a different, random situation. And it was always wonderful. I always liked that. It was just kind of beautiful. So
it's very much in the spirit of her philosophies as well, because she played with the idea of time. This wasn't supposed to reflect the real world, but the internal world. And in some ways, it achieves it much more through that random.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So when I'm playing with... last night's performance, I was improvising, but I had certain distinct ideas that I wanted to accomplish. I mean, I wasn't jamming. Let's put it that way.
That's a really important difference, though, isn't it? That there is. It's not just there is some structure in some way around that improvisation.
Yeah, and so I was just really sort of I knew which order the films were and what the dynamic of each film was, and I try not to look at the film because I don't want it to sort of I don't want it to influence me too much. I'm basically just for responding to the light. And I want to know when each film ends because I want to move into the next space. So it's a little tricky because, you know, sometimes the credits just happen like that and you realize
you're just rocking in, pull out.
But I played with Maya Deren's films recently in Portugal, and I actually did a composition that was about the same amount of time as the film program, and I played this composition. I don't think it was as successful. I felt a little more sort of assured because it's like, okay, I have this composition, and it's about the same time, and wherever it lands, it will land. But I think it didn't work as well, like, because I wasn't really feeling the film in a way.
Because there were some real transcendent moments last night, you know.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I think it definitely had the aspect to take it higher than perhaps it would have.
Yeah, but it allowed me to move with the light of the film. I would just sort of glance and sort of see what was happening sometimes, and then I would sort of move accordingly. But I think improvisation for me is, it takes a lot much more, it takes much more of a concentration of mind as far as being a musician. And I've always been really, well, not always, but at some point in my life, I became very interested, almost very devoted to getting into a free improvisation as a musical vocabulary.
As mentioned at the top, she's one of the founders, I guess, of avant-garde film in America. When you arrive in New York in the 70s, she had already, you know, been doing that kind of work in that city since, you know, the 40s. Was there a spirit still alive around that idea of art in New York? You know, I suppose art for devotion to art beyond anything else. Is that what New York was when you arrived?
I mean, coming to a city like New York in the late 70s as a young person, I think it was like any kind of metropolis where that was where the creative eye was, because it was so, you know, we didn't really have the interconnectivity we have now as far as information. And So you would go to the city because that's where the media was, that's where the information was, and so you could utilize that. But I think that idea of doing work where it didn't necessitate capital, like money was not a part of the agenda at all, was still definitely still in the air. The city was fairly impoverished at that time, especially for artists. But an artist could live in poverty. And that poverty was fairly glorious.
I want to ask you about that, because Maya Deren, when she died, it was at a point in her life where she was barely able to eat. You've also said about that time of poverty that it was some of your happiest rolling around a city making music. Do you think there's a connection between...
retrospect, maybe. Yeah, I mean, you know, in real time, it's a drag. I mean, it's like nobody, you know, everybody... You wants to feel some kind of satisfaction with themselves in that way. Nobody wants to have that kind of struggle. But when you're young, you can sort of withstand it a bit. You know, you don't really sort of have that sense of termination in your life. That, you know, that impending kind of shelf life that comes late. But I don't know if happiness is the right word. But you know, in retrospect, you always. You know, you always think of this certain kind of beauty and glory that existed in your younger days that maybe at the time wasn't so true. You know.
You've also said you wish you'd lived there 10 years earlier. Why?
To have lived anywhere in the 1960s would have been amazing. I mean, I have being born in 1958, I was 10 years old in 68, so I have some kind of I certainly have memories of the 60s, but, you know, I was very young. But to have been of age, to have been in my 20s in the 60s, I would have loved that. I mean, that kind of cultural transition that was going on in youth culture, especially at that time, and where it was just, the reality of the 60s is something else besides the romantic kind of retrospect of the 60s. I mean, most people I know who sort of, lived that time have nothing but these wonderful memories, but they also have these memories of the anxiety of dealing with specifically the Vietnam War that was like, you know, so all encompassing as like a demonic force, you know, in their daily lives. So would I've liked to have been subjected to that anxiety? Probably not. You know, so when we look at the activism of the 60s, which was so completely necessary, you know, it was pretty, that's not exactly a good time, you know. I mean, we can celebrate it for what it accomplished. And it did accomplish something. It actually brought, like, I think it really sort of heightened a lot of people's perception of, you know, like state control, you know, that was happening all around the world. Whereas I think in the 40s and 50s, that was... maybe not so much the case. I mean, I think people sort of accepted that as being, you know, that was okay. I mean, you know, for youth culture to sort of, you know, and it wasn't all of youth culture. I mean, it was just definitely sort of like a demographic that was really distinct, but it was a very loud and vocal demographic.
New York is the canvas, you know. How much do you play into that idea that the city has got an important part to play in the art that you make? If you had a stayed in Connecticut, would you have been the same artist as you are?
I was living in like rural Connecticut, which was only just about an hour outside of New York City. Does the city sort of, are you saying like this is the city sort of, does it really have an inspiration?
Yeah, I guess. And does it have a real significant part to play in art making and what comes?
Yeah. I mean, to elucidate on that, I don't know. I mean, I really love the community of the city. I mean, I liked having this world of people around me, and that you would, you know, you would leave your apartment and you would just be in this this population of just like people from all over the world. New York was like this, that was not really indicative of the rest of the USA. I mean, it was a place that was very international, and there was such diversity there. And that was, I really felt, you really felt part of a larger world by being in the city. And I just wanted to, I just really liked the idea of like a thriving community of people. And I liked, and I really liked the different forces at work and at play that were happening in the city that you can immediately access. And it was extremely, important for me to be there. I don't know if how I would have gotten into any kind of mode of expression outside of the city, really, to tell you the truth. I wasn't an isolationist, although I love isolationist music. I really like kind of like, what's his name? Streborg, you know, the black metal guy from Tasmania. He kind of do you know about this guy?
Write it down.
He's a Tasmanian black metal artist, and he's just like, he lives in isolation and does his work.
There's something interesting about that.
And so I kind of relate to it a little bit, because you kind of want to go off into your sort of intellectual cave a little bit and like do that. But at the same time, I'm always sort of, I sort of crave the company of people like I don't necessarily know. And I sort of like being in that swarm in a way. And I find it, because I find people preternaturally kind of really holistic, you know. I think whatever kind of dark forces come into play with people's own sort of problematic worldviews are learned from kind of other rottenness in the world. But I think preternaturally people are kind of really fantastic.
That's so nice to hear these days, where people are good. Endorse my wisdom more.
The other night, I saw that film, The Australian Dream, and there was an undercurrent.
Who else did we see that? Have we seen it yet?
It's really recommended to see that movie. I mean, but I think there was an undercurrent in that dialogue in that film that was just that. You know, it was like this idea of just really wanting to sort of have this mutual respect and trust for each other, and knowing that it's there, it's just something, you know, it becomes an issue when, you know, when, it's a family situation, it's a social situation.
And I was asking you before, having seen that film as sort of an outsider looking at Australian history, it isn't really necessarily confined to Australia, though. We could apply the same experience, you know, America, obviously the UK, where you are now.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, yeah. I mean, USA has its own history as such, obviously. And certainly Australia does too. But I think it's really important to sort of to tell the stories of our environments to each other. And, you know, I thought that movie was completely important, really significant, especially for where we are now as in our lives as all together, you know,
one beat
right now. It's like, you know, and so the power of, you know, the power of cinema is just like, is just so incredible that we have that in our lifetime, because it's really in our lifetime, you know, it's just, you know, the last 100 years, you know, so, to see work like that, and to see a work like that, like a documentary film, as sort of like the key film in like a film festival of this magnitude, this stature, I was impressed. I'm not trying to, you know,
we like to be sucked up too. Don't worry, we respond well.
I didn't know really what to expect. I just wanted to see this movie, and I don't know that story. I don't know the story of the football player,
Adam Goods,
yeah. and what that. I heard there was another film on Australian TV that sort of was more about like what happened.
Yeah, it's a really interesting film to sit beside it. It's called The Final Quarter.
That's right.
And rather than it being narrated or having the players in the story tell it, it's actually just archival footage put together and it tells its own story. Mm-hmm. So it has an incredible power in that as well.
And the Australian Dream was more, it seemed more like a movie about like what it meant as opposed to like exactly what happened.
What happened its ramifications. Thinking about New York still, it's changed so much. You know, we can probably isolate that down to one individual that's made some drastic changes. Do you think if a city has a spirit, that the spirit can be lost?
Oh, I think that, you know, I think every generation has its own experience in a city, you know, be it New York or Melbourne or whatever. When I started working with younger people, you know, it's weird being like in a musician or an artist and you figure you're going to do that for the rest of your life because there's really no retirement age to it. So you start going through generations of people. So when you get into your 30s and 40s, people who are your same age start dropping off and getting into more domesticated situations or more sort of secure situations in their life. And but you continue to do this kind of work that was sort of defined by your youth. And so there's this aspect of like never growing up in a way. So it's a strange sense of sort of having a bit of responsibility to yourself, you know, because, you know, I never really sort of equated what I did with revenue. You know, so the idea of like having the responsibility of making money to sort of, you know, support yourself or the family situation you have, I find it irrelative in a way, but it's just like I realize that you know I have to sort of deal with it in a way that's less specific than a typical domestic kind of lifestyle. So that said, you start working, you find yourself, as you get older, working with people who are kind of entering into your world and you start working with younger people. And I've always liked that. And so by the time I got into my 40s, I found myself working with a lot of people who were maybe a good generation or a decade younger than me. And then there was this other crew that was like a decade older as well. I always felt like in the middle of it, like there was very few people like my age that I was sort of having connections with. And that's still kind of the case in a way. And
where do you feel, do you still feel like there's an alignment with that youth exploration? And is that the occupation of the young person in a way? Is it about age?
Maybe. I'm not sure how to answer that actually. I think I got to a point where I really don't ever, I refuse to be judgmental about age. To underestimate the intelligence of anybody younger than me is like ridiculous. And I notice that happening in a lot of places in my life culturally where there's that. To me, it's like when you see somebody like as young as like this girl Greta Thunberg, who's like a climate activist. You know, I mean, that's like, okay, you're the most brilliant person on earth right now. You know, but you know when you see somebody like Boris Johnson or Donald Trump sort of coming into power, you know, over like these, you know, these two of the most significant countries like in the Western world, it kind of makes you wonder. What world we live in. So,
we're going to talk extensively. You've got an album coming out called Spirit Council. It's coming out in September. But we'll get to that. But we also want to travel back to the time probably that we first met you in Sonic Youth. We got to do it. Was there an intention for you at that time to invent, to make music that had an invention to it that was new?
Well, I felt like it was already happening, and I think the idea was just to be like completely and utterly part of it, And so it was like, it was just beyond inspiration. I mean, you know, at that, especially at that time, you know, I remember like when I first started like writing music with Sonic Youth. I mean, you know, Sonic Youth sort of started as a coming out of this situation where you just had to do it. I, you know, the name came from the guitar player and the MC5, Fred Sonic Smith, and it had less to do with like the music, but just sort of like what he represented it as, you know, as this like this thing of like beauty, you know, like you would see him with his fist raised in the air, like, you know, doing a power chord, like in like this urban, you know, zone of Detroit, Michigan, and, you know, singing these songs, you know, that were just like really activist and so, and Youth came from the, it came from like Big Youth and all, and the idea that the word youth was used a lot in the lexicon of reggae music. And reggae music was like this really radical rebel music that was concurrent with punk rock at the time, and stating its case as a new definition of like contemporary youth culture in the 70s, away from the fallout of hippie and the idea of having to be kind of a musical, you know, not having to be Eric Clapton or whatever, you know what I'm saying? You could be Johnny Ramone or something. And so that's where the name came from. And that's sort of like, to me, it was like the name had to sort of be perfect. And so...
It's the worst conversations you ever have with other people is how to name your band.
Yeah, to me, it was all about the, you know, you had to sort of like have that title first. And so... It kind of floundered a bit, like when we were first sort of playing as a group. Like there's different names that were sort of floating around. We did a few different gigs under a few different names, and until I came in one day and said, "This is, I want to use this as a name," and things changed automatically. Then, like from that day, I remember, and all of a sudden it became galvanized. But you know, the idea was just sort of to create a music that was completely free and uplifting, that kind of did not, it didn't have any agenda to it to become, it wasn't about becoming popular, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and that becomes a problem when you do become popular, because for a long time you were sitting outside challenging sonically stuff, you know, and also culturally there was a challenge there. When that then becomes the inside by no will of your own, how do you manage that?
Well, I don't know. our profile sort of became more elevated as the 80s went along, and you know, people started responding to us critically, you know, and it was always, you know, I was really into the literature of the music. It's for me, like rock writers in the 70s were as important as the rock musicians, and I was really interested in the journalism of music. And so there was writers like Patti Smith. I mean, I knew Patti Smith as a rock writer before I knew her as a musician, and she was. And so I would see her byline in Rolling Stone or Cream or Rock Scene or. All the magazines that were primarily coming out of New York City at the time. Rolling Stone was it was the only sort of outlier in San Francisco, and they're coming out of hippie culture. But you know, by the mid 70s, Rolling Stone had moved to New York City and wanted to be like where the action was there, as hippie culture sort of started getting more commodified. And so. That whole milieu of writers particularly in the USA, people like Lester Bangs and Richard Meltzer and Patti Smith herself, their writing was like, it had, you know, this equal value energy that was in the music, and they were of the same age, and they were, you know, so they were sort of exacting the same expression. And that was really that was really significant for me. That was really important to me to just to know. And why I brought that up is like, I'm not quite sure, but I guess I brought it up because I was always very aware and very cogent of what was being written about our band and what we were doing in the early 80s. And so when there was some response from somebody, say, like Grail Marcus, who was like a really well-regarded music writer, that was extremely important to me, as important as other musicians sort of giving us a thumbs up. That sort of changed, obviously, through the years.
Yeah, has rock journalism and your early deep respect for it as being an equal player, has it changed over time as well?
Well, it's less maybe centralized as it was at that time. I think like the music itself, it's become so much more of a broad enterprise. You know, it's funny when I remember having dialogue with people who would come out of the late 60s, early 70s world of music, and they're like, oh, you know, when we were coming up, everybody kind of knew the same bands. Like, we knew Cream and Led Zeppelin, and like, everybody knew it was on the same page. And now it's like, what's going on? There's like, you know, there's like 60,000 bands with records every day. And I was like, well, that's good. That's a good thing. You know, I mean, some people have issues with that, where it's like, it should just be like focused on the visionaries, you know, and like, I was like, no, I think everybody should be able to have that equality of expression that's going on. And I don't really underestimate any culture from sort of like having to be able to choose what they think is important to themselves, you know? So I think like the library has exploded, which I really like, you know? I mean, I think that was sort of the utopian idea anyway behind having this kind of universal access to information anyway, you know, regardless of how it's orchestrated through, you know, Russia.
Which one? Russia. You were photographed, I think we saw something online, you were at, you know, record stores when you arrived here a couple of days ago. How are you still a big fan? And what do you, or are you finding sort of stuff from back, or are you finding new stuff when you listen to music?
Oh man, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm pretty obsessive, relentless kind of.
This is now therapy.
Yeah, this is kind of weird. I find like that's where I want to kind of be in. I'm a frustrated librarian.
For any rock journalist, that's your headline. That's fantastic. What do you mean? Because it is about the archiving and the collection and the categorization and the understanding of the mass, or what?
There's a certain, I sort of like, just, I mean, not to sound too esoteric or whatever, I mean, I just sort of like the vibrational aspects of gift culture. You know, when young people say like, oh, what should we do? You know, like, how do we move forward? I was like, well, make something, you know, and don't make it don't make it as a commodity necessarily to like that exchange for cash, you know, like just make it to give to somebody. Like that's your calling card. So spend your, like, try to make some money and make something with it. Like make a record, make a cassette, make a CD.
That changes fundamental, you know, application to the art as well, though, doesn't it? Because if it's not about money, then, and if it is about giving, changes the way you think about what you make.
Yeah. I mean, but also, I mean, use what you have at hand. I have no issues with digital culture. I mean, use Bandcamp, et cetera. I think that's great. You know, I mean, everybody is the same in that situation. And I like the things that are the same. You know, like that, it's even like, the whole thing of like all reggae music sounds the same, all country and western music sounds the same, all jazz sounds the same. It's like, well, that's why I like genres that sound the same. I like this idea of like this shared idea of what these tropes are in this kind of in the language of these different genres and subgenres.
Wasn't your music about disrupting that though?
What?
Wasn't Sonic Youth early stuff about disrupting those tropes and breaking
them. I don't
know
what we were about. I mean, I really don't. I mean, to me, it was just like, it was all sort of defined by economics. I mean, we couldn't really afford to have decent guitars. And all of us just sort of had a modicum of experience playing music anyway. I think Lee had the most sort of musical history as far as he could actually play Jerry Garcia licks and stuff like that. I could barely play Louie Louie. And, and Kim was extremely rudimentary. She was coming to it as a visual artist, you know, and the first drummers we had were just, it was day one, you know. So, to us, I mean, the idea was just sort of just like to, you know, just to start at ground zero and move forward and just taking on all these, these ideas that we were loving in our community, which at that time in New York City was, you know, it wasn't so much the punk rock scene, because punk rock in New York was never really that sort of typical. It was never that straightforward. I mean, you sort of had like the template of the Ramones, and then you had this kind of post-New York Dolls kind of music of like Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. And then you had this kind of import from the Midwest, which was like this band called the Dead Boys. And then you had this really sort of completely off the walls performance art music of like Suicide, Alan Vega and Martin Rev, which was, you know, all these things were really important. And then you had this, then you had Patti Smith Group, which was, you know, pretty much this woman who was a writer and a poet fronting a band, and the band was fairly straightforward, they were kind of a rock and roll band, you know, and what the light was this woman espousing this kind of amazing lyricism and this kind of performance. And then you had this extension of like what was kind of downtown New York sort of cabaret kind of post-war whole factory kind of like a rock and roll that Blondie came out of, you know. And so there's all these different strains. And then you sort of had obviously bands like Talking Heads coming out of art school and coming down to New York and establishing themselves, or a band like Mink DeVille, which had more of a Latino aspect to it. And so it was extremely diverse. There wasn't one specific like punk rock sound. And that was actually coming more from Europe or London, you know, certainly. And so hearing bands like the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the Buzzcocks, that seemed more sort of like this collective that had one idea of like what that sound was, and it was extremely great and exciting, but it was not what New York was about, you know. And so, I mean, I think there's, you know, when Johnny Rotten would talk about it at the time, when he would say like, I wish there were more bands like the Sex Pistols. He always sort of clarified that later, saying like, I did not mean there was more bands that sounded like the Sex Pistols. He's like, I want more bands to be able to be really self-expressive without sounding like each other. And that sort of came into play, obviously, with bands like the Slits and the Raincoats and Pop Group. And, you know, that disparity was there. It was very natural. But I'm not quite
sure. You're a librarian. That's all we've taken away. No, we like beautiful.
The Sonic Youth thing. I mean, that was the mindset. That was the milieu. That was sort of where we were. And so our immediate surroundings, what we were interested in what was going on in our community with music like that we were hearing from the Contortions or Teenage Jesus and the Jerks and Glenn Branca and Reese Chatham, and that was our neighborhood, and we just wanted to be part of that, and so we weren't looking to go beyond 14th Street at that point.
Mick Harvey was at the films yesterday. Yeah. He's not here. So hopefully he's not here. We'll talk about him while he's not here. I remember asking him once about, you know, he described making a band, or a band is not, you know, as we've said, not the best drummer, it's not about the best guitarist, it's this moment in time where this group of people collaborate in such a way that the outcome is what it is. Sonic Youth was absolutely that collaboration. It was equal parts moving in that direction for such a long time. When that's over, do you seek that collaboration again? Or do you...
Yeah, I have not at all. I mean, I love collaborating certainly with people from just different just places and aspects of music and art, whatever. But I don't ever seek to sort of reclaim what that was. I mean, you really are only new once in a way. I mean, you can renew in different ways. But I was talking to David Toop, who's a good friend of ours, and he has just turned 7 years old. He's been engaged with the margins and the underground of music since the late '60s. And I was asking him, what his perspective was in '77 when he was doing just a really experimental free improvised music around London, and what he thought of punk rock as it was coming up. And he said, well, you know, the best bands were the ones who didn't know how to play. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I mean, you don't know how to play for a short time. You invariably, you learn how to play,
and you
become
it.
Different. So you can't pretend to not know how to play. And if you are, it's a little sort of disingenuous.
But is it learning how to play when you do that with a group? That's what actually becomes that kind of oneness. Yeah.
I think at some point, I remember we did I think our third or fourth record was called Bad Moon Rising. And I remember coming into rehearsal and I had some kind of picking idea that maybe was influenced by a band called the Feelies, who were around New York at the time, who were really exciting. And I was just like, oh, maybe we should, instead of just bashing on drumsticks underneath the 12th fret of the guitar or drilling holes into the guitar with the amplifiers on 12, maybe we should start doing something a little more nimble and and maybe, with some kind of respect to some kind of traditional aspect of guitar playing. And I always remember coming in and it was a bit of a surprise. I remember Lee looking at me, he was like, what are you doing? Why are you putting your fingers on the frets? And but yeah, so it's like that process of creating your own sort of musical world, especially in a bit of a so-called sonic democracy of a band, that's something I loved, but I'm not really, it's not something I feel like I want to do again. It's sort of like, I don't want to, it's not like I'm going to get leg tattoos or something. I'm too old for this. So it's like, there's something about acting your age,
No leg tattoos.
No, but,
there's a question here. We've actually got some audience questions that have come through. I was going to leave them to last, but this kind of fits in right now with, talking about that guitar. Someone put a question in, said, you've had your heavily modified equipment stolen. You've had a Fender guitar design named after you. How important is the instrument? And is this something you've struggled with over time? The actual
hardware? Well, I never really thought of myself as such a proficient guitarist where I should be in sort of the pantheon of legendary guitarists. And but I liked the guitar because I kind of wanted to be a drummer early on, but I didn't have my hand to foot coordination wasn't there at all. I had
how early on was this before New York? You thought drums?
Oh yeah.
In the bedroom.
Yeah, I had a drum pad, and I tried to play Mom and Dad, and it wasn't my thing. And plus, I think the idea of carrying around a drum set, didn't appeal to me. There was guitars in my household. I had an older brother who always had a guitar, and so I would always steal his guitar and play and break strings, and we would fight and all this kind of thing. And he eventually gave me a guitar that was that quote unquote fallen off a truck and that eventually got stolen out of my apartment in New York by my next door neighbor at the time. Yeah, I mean, guitar is just sort of, I mean, for me, it was just sort of, it was, um, it, it, It was just there. I mean, I would have played anything. I played the flute for a while, but then.
How old were you when you played flute?
Like maybe 14, mm-hmm. and I kind of excelled at it, and but then the music teacher in our school, we had to do a program, and he said we all had to wear bow ties, and I refused to, so I just didn't show up. I was like, I'm not going to wear a bow tie. And so I didn't show up, and I gave him my notice. I said, I don't want to be in this program anymore. But I didn't tell him that it was because of the bow tie.
Yeah,
I just said, I just don't want to. And he was really upset. He said, you're the only one who knows how to play, you know. And so I felt kind of flattered, but also kind of, you know, like, this isn't going to work out. No, the guitar just sort of came into my life. And again, like I said before, like by the time, after my, the guitar my brother gave to me got stolen, I was subjected to using whatever I could use. And so it would be the like $20 guitars from pawn shops or whatever. And then when I, you know, when I met Lee and then when I met Kim, we just sort of like kind of were sharing like whatever we had access to, and we would borrow things, and we just started kind of collaborating and making a band together. And Lee was already playing with Glenn Branca, who was doing music for multiple guitars. And when he found out that we were in cahoots, the three of us, and because we were sort of from the same community down there, he encouraged it. And we said we don't have any guitars to play. Can we borrow some? And he said, certainly. And I always remember him coming over to our apartment with like, you know, three or four guitars under each arm that he owned without cases, and just bringing them in here, try these. And they were just these beat up guitars, and he had shaved the headstocks so they were spears. You know? and I had already been kind of blown away by what he was doing, and not realizing that what he was doing was he was actually sort of tuning the guitars into different, less non-traditional tunings. And so the first time I saw him play, it was like six electric guitars and creating a sound that I had always wanted to hear, and there it was. And what I realized is like one guitar was like, you know, the high E string, the next guitar was the G string, and the next guitar was the D string, A string. And so he had created these six guitars as six strings, but each guitar had six, you know, so it was like this huge guitar, like, oh, that's cool. You know, and then, so when he gave us these guitars, they were already tuned into these tunings. Like one guitar just had all like 10 gauge high E strings on it, so it was like this, like, and I was like, oh, that's great. And so we immediately started like running songs just by like implementing these guitars, and eventually sort of changing the tunings. And so it was this really liberated thing where I would just sit there and plug into this tiny little amp, and I would just strum open and start changing the tuning pegs until it was like an open tuning that I thought sounded cool, and then I would start noting it a little bit, or like using different ways of altering the sound, and that's really how it all began in a way.
He's so significant in your life, and in fact, the album that's coming out in September, Spirit Council, has a song that is in homage to him. It's called 8 Spring Street.
Yeah, I mean, it's called 8 Spring Street, which is where Glenn Branca lived at the time. And I had seen him perform, and he took an ad out in the local paper asking for a guitarist to play, and I immediately sort of called him up. And we had never really met,
It's really early times when you've just moved to New York, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it was around 78, 79. And I just went over to his apartment at 8 Spring Street. And, you know, we certainly had mutual acquaintances. And I just started playing with him. And he was, like, showing me different things he was doing. And I felt like I already knew them. And I think he was a little sort of taken aback by that. He goes, well, I do this thing called double strumming. Can you do that? And I was like, yeah. I mean, who can't do that? And he's like, well, nobody can do that. I was like, well, I can do that. I can triple strum. And he was, you know, and so it's things like this. And so he didn't hire me at first because he thought I was too, I was too wild, and he didn't want to contain me or something. That's sort
no
of
bow ties so for you.
And, but you know, I was really impressed because he had a window fan, and he said he just listens to the overtones coming off the window fan blades, and he wanted to sort of create compositions that were just like this multiphonic window fan music. And I thought that was as good a, that was talk about like city music. I mean, my God, you know. So I was impressed by that. But certainly Glenn had more, I think, sophisticated kind of ideas as far as like making music. And that said, you know, it was like when you sort of, when you start working with sort of experimental ideas in your guitar music, I became very interested in what that history was in experimental music. And so when you'd realize that, you know, Tony Conrad, Lamont Young, and these different composers who sort of like devoted their musical lives to that experimentation and like and the different that lineage of it, you know, like, and so it was very there was a lot of academic kind of concern and history to it, and that was to this day, you know, for me to get into that bank of knowledge is fantastic, and it's you know it's an unending well of information.
He also put out early Sonic Youth recordings. What did he make of Sonic Youth?
Glenn did. He put out our first record. He started a label called Neutral. I think he thought we were at that time we were together for just less than a year. We're like. The appropriate representatives of what he wanted to establish is like, you know, this sound of downtown New York at the time. Because a lot of the bands that we sort of had come out of had become a little more traditionalized. I mean, a lot of the no wave bands, like I mentioned previously, like Contortions and Teenage Jesus and DNA and Mars. You know, they were very, they had nothing at all to do with any aspect of like kind of blues-based rock and roll music so much. But they eventually became more practiced. And so they found themselves going into playing more sort of traditional kind of rock tropes and motifs. And in a way, that sort of ends no wave, you know, because as soon as you learned how to play, you were something else entirely. You were actually, you know, proper. So I think he sort of saw us as this group that was really sort of representing that transition and keeping this balance between being somewhat untutored yet progressive, you know. So I think that he saw that. And he put our first record out.
Listening again, referring to the new album that's about to come out. It's three pieces. The first one is an hour long. And what was interesting for me listening to it was, I think, recognizing early work of yours and this work as having some connection. For me, it was almost like, I love this. This is
I
refer
that.
To it from my first listening to you and your guitars. Do you see a connection from those early days to the music that you make now?
Yeah, I sort of, about a year or so ago, I thought I would sort of take a break from just like more typical songwriting that I've been doing since the beginning of Sonic Youth, which is sort of like the idea and the glory of the song, you know, whether it be 1 minute or it be 6 minutes. I mean, Sonic Youth songs tended to be rather long, you know, from the 4 to 6 minute and more, but I didn't mind that so much. I mean, it was always sort of a bit of an anxious thing of like, the more popular we got, the more there was pressure to like write shorter pieces of music so they could be formatted into like the media of radio and MTV and such. So there was always that bit of a struggle there of trying to sort of comply with that wish. But, you know, we never did, you know, we kept writing longer music. And so for what it's worth, I always just loved the idea of the format of the song. And to me, the experimentation in Sonic Youth wasn't so much the tunings or the implementations in the guitars or the noise or the feedback. It was mostly, the experimentation was mostly about structure. You know, to me, like, what can still be sort of regarded as a proper rock song or experimental rock song and still be a song, and like, to experiment with structure. So a lot of Sonic Youth songs would be, you know, there would be maybe an extrapolated intro, and then there would be this other section, and then a vocal would come in. I mean, things were sort of displaced in the traditional aspect of songwriting, but sort of making it a quote-unquote song. So it was the idea of being sort of experimental, but still being songcraft, like a throbbing gristle kind of thing, where it's just this wholly other kind of beast of music. And it's because we actually really loved that, we would always sort of wear that on our sleeves. We would, like, Creedence Clearwater Revival is as great a thing as, you know, the New Blockaders, you know, or something like that. The New Blockaders being like this extreme industrial group. So that was really, that was something that we really sort of wanted to sort of express. And so I felt like I was working like that for quite a long time. And it was, a couple of years ago, I just figured I would maybe focus on doing what I felt like doing, which was like writing longer pieces of music. And I got a commission to do something at a theater in London called the Barbican, which is part, it's a museum space. And the idea was that I would do a piece for 12 string guitars. And so it was just that idea alone gave me this parameter where I could sit down and actually sort of write a composition for 12 string guitars, and just getting...
Are you literally notating?
Yeah. I would get I would get guitar staves and I would print them out and I would sort of notate it, and I would compose the piece and slowly write it down and just work with it. And I just kind of locked the door and did that for about a solid month or so. And then I employed 11 guitarists, and some who actually knew how to play the guitar and some who didn't. And that was kind of important to me, not to have it just be sort of like flash guitar players. I wanted it to be that kind of dynamic of people who kind of, you know, said they could do it, or that challenge, you know. And it worked out. And so I did a piece for 12 string electrics and for an hour, and then there was an intermission, and it was 12 string acoustic and guitars. And so that kind of, and it was really rewarding for me as a songwriter. It's like, I wanted to focus on that more. I really always liked that kind of music writing anyway. And I felt it was sort of time to sort of focus on that. So I've been sort of, that's what I've been doing with this London group I have. It's myself and this guitar player named James Edwards and a bass player named Deb Googe, who you may know from My Bloody Valentine, and Steve Shelley, and the drummer. And then I would have a couple of different guitar players come in and out of the fold if need be, if I can afford to have them at the gig or not. And then I employed a electronic musician who works with this San Francisco group called Negative Land, who've been around forever. And his name is John Lydecker, but he works under the name Wobbly. And I came across his work from doing some John Cage concert with this woman, Tanya Chen. And anyway, so he's become part of this group. And the group has been touring for years, for the last like 7 years or so, playing music that I've done on a couple of albums of songs. There was an album called Rock and Roll Consciousness and another album called The Best Days. So this is all instrumental music. I put the microphone away, don't really need the monitors anymore. And it's just about focusing on the instrumentation of electric guitars. And so this piece, Alice Smoky Jane.
Yeah, I really want to know about that. Alice Smoky Jane is the first one, and it celebrates three significant women.
Yeah.
How do you tell the story when there are no vocals? And how do you write it with that story?
I'm telling a story of these three women. When I was writing this piece, there was a certain motif in an Alice Coltrane piece that was really, it was part of one of her devotional song pieces, which are very sort of simplistic, but really evocative and a very deep kind of music experiences. And there was this really, this slight figure of music that she was doing with her voice. And as I was sort of like playing the guitar and thinking of different compositional ideas, I had heard something in what was happening. I said, oh, that it brought to mind this piece of Alice Coltrane's. And so I kept focusing on that and having that sort of define the rest of the piece. I don't think you would really recognize it listening to it, but I do. And so I was just sort of dedicating the piece to Alice Coltrane. And, you know, I've been sort of, and Eva and I have been working on doing a book, we were thinking about doing a book of the work of Moki Cherry, who was the artist who was involved with Don Cherry, the jazz trumpeter with Ornette Coleman's group and beyond. And then getting involved with a writer who wanted to do a book on Don Cherry, who we're actually still kind of working with. And so we've been doing music books for a number of years. And so these are a couple of books that we were sort of talking about. And so we got to be talking with the people who are very close to Don Cherry, specifically Nana Cherry and her daughter. And becoming really interested in Moki Cherry. And for my interest in Moki Cherry really stems from the Sonic Youth record, Bad Moon Rising, which is the burning scarecrow on the front. That was, that scarecrow is in Brooklyn in this yard that was behind a building right next to the Hudson River, the East River, I'm sorry, the Hudson River's west. And we were allowed to use this property because of Moki Cherry, and Moki Cherry was a friend of a woman that I was working for scraping ceilings at the time. And so I had met Moki and was telling her about this idea for an album cover for my band, where I wanted to have this like this kind of Americana on fire thing. And I didn't know where to do it in New York City. I mean, you'd get arrested immediately if you were sort of burning an effigy of a scarecrow in the middle of the street. So she said, oh, I have this land. And so that's, you know, that was my connection to her. But then I started realizing what her work was by seeing her album covers that she had done for Don Cherry, that were these beautiful fabric art pieces that were just all about celebration and life and love and just these, and so finding out more about her life was really essential. And Nana was talking about Moki and Alice being friendly, and then they start talking about Jane Cortez, and so she's the Jane of the title. And Jane Cortez was a woman who was involved with Ornette Coleman. I believe they were married, and the three of them were involved with each other as artists, you know, but without the the idolatry that their husbands had, you know, as being popular figures. It was, and they didn't necessitate that, you know, in their lives. All they needed was each other and their work, seemingly. And so, you know, I didn't know these women so much, but for me writing this piece, I thought like I felt like I wanted to dedicate this music to them, you know, these visionary artists, that's all that really is.
You know. Almost like Maya Deren, it helps us, I guess, come to the work as well. You know, through you we can go elsewhere as well. Do you believe it's already been an hour? And
I
more.
What?
It's been an hour.
Oh, okay.
I don't even have time necessarily to read any of the audience questions. We need to wrap up. But it's just, we could do this for another two, I reckon. It's wonderful to speak to you about art and your work. And as we said, this album is coming out in September. And yes, Hopefully we'll have you back soon enough to be playing the music.
We hope to come here after the new year. That's the idea.
Great.
It's been too long. And I would really, I'm only here for 2 or 3 days this time. And just to do that concert last night was really special.
It was really special.
I was really happy to be here. So I look forward to coming back.
I think We love him. Is that true?
No. Oh,
let's thank very much Thurston Moore.
Thank you.
So generous. Thank you for that. Huge thank you to Miff, who made this happen, and also the Wheeler Centre. And of course, there's merch outside. So you had a merch bag and you're like, I don't even know what's in here, but it's going to be good.
Yeah. Merch and destroy, we call it.
Merch and destroy. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Thurston Moore.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.